In our next segment, we turn to a recording of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee Field Secretary Matthew Jones, who talks about his involvement in the civil rights movement from the sit-in movement to the freedom rides and later the voter registration drive leading up to the 1964 presidential election.
My name is Matthew Jones. I'm from Knoxville, Tennessee. And I've worked with SNCC in all areas of the South. And to begin this talk, I guess I should start with what happened in 1960 when I was a student at Tennessee State University in Nashville. There was a movement just beginning to start. It was around February. It was in the latter part of February. And there were some students that started to go down to restaurants in the area, sitting in. And most of the students at ANI, they say, you know, this must be some kind of hogwash. You know, what is this new idea, this Gandhi? You know, everybody wanted to know what it was. And we weren't really interested one way or another. We knew that we needed to be able to eat in these restaurants. But we were really afraid, you know, it was brand new. And I read the paper the next day, and I saw this white fella laying out with his head bloody under some stools at this Woolworth counter. And I became so embarrassed, you know. This white fella doing, you know, my job for me. And I decided right there, you know, that I had to do something. I'll never forget, I went to this assembly where the president of the university was talking. And he told us that the governor of Tennessee would give us two $30,000 buses if we wouldn't demonstrate, if we wouldn't go uptown and try to sit in and get a hamburger. And I became frustrated at that moment, and I just walked out, and I walked a mile up the road, you know, where these people were, these sit-iners, you know, this new thing was going on. And I walked in, and they gave me some lessons in nonviolence, and they said, look, said, we don't want anybody to go but people who have gone before, but I wanted to go so bad, you know, I wanted to join the struggle so bad that I told them, you know, that I had been arrested before. And I went uptown to this restaurant. It's called Kane Sloan's. And we walked in, and we were supposed to go in and sit down. But when we got there, this big chain was across the door. And, well, we decided, you know, we mapped out our strategy. We said, well, we'll stand in front of this chain, you know, and if anyone would come up, we would tell them that we were there first and we'd like to be served. And, well, the manager came up and he said, well, you boys will have to move away because my customers have to come in. You know, we told them we were customers because we had just bought something at the other counters. And they still wouldn't let us in. And, you know, and we stood at this chain, and I'll never forget, there was a big mirror in front of me. And we saw the white people beginning to come in. It was about 250 in this basement. And this big white fella, around 260 pounds, came rushing toward my back, you know, and I was looking in the mirror, you know, and I just braced myself, you know, and I just looked in the mirror, and he ran up and he stopped right behind me, and he shook his head, you know, and he walked away. I was really frightened because I was ready, you know, to go through this mirror. And they took us to jail. It was my first time in jail. It was a very depressing thing, you know. Very few people had been to jail for civil rights, you know, at that time, and we really didn't know what it was all about. So from then, I began to work in the Nashville student movement. And it just so happened, I graduated from school, from college that year, and the president had told us, said, look, sir, if you demonstrate, Matthew, you know, he took us into this this little conference, so you won't be able to graduate. And I told him, graduate into what? You know, I wanted to know what. To be Uncle Tom like he was. You know, I was really upset, you know, because I began to see what was really going on. Well, at the end of that year, you know, I, like everybody else, we have, we wonder whether we should really go into things like this. We had been taught so long that education was the solution. And I decided, I said, look, should I go wholeheartedly into the movement or should I teach school for a while? Well, I taught school, and not knowing that this is freedom, you know, that I would not be able to sit back anymore. I lost two jobs, you know, and I decided then that if I really wanted to educate kids, that I would have to change the system. And I dropped teaching, and I went to graduate school in Knoxville, Tennessee, where I became real involved. Marion Barry, ex-chairman of SNCC, was also going to school, you know, at the same place. So I decided there that I would join the movement full time. And this was in the summer of 1963. I had already been arrested about 15 times. Now, in talking about personal experiences and in terms of nonviolence, I would like to relate to you an experience that I had in Danville, Virginia. I was placed in jail there in a very small cell with no running water, and they had me on a fast for, I shouldn't say fast, really, they just wouldn't feed me, you know. I shouldn't use terms of fast and what jailers do. Well, they had this very large demonstration. Martin Luther King had come into town, and there was a long line of about 200 people. But really, you know, only 13 went to jail. Basically because a week or so before then, 49 people had been beaten pretty near to death, and had been 200-pound pressure fire hoses had been turned on them, and people were really afraid. So 13 of us went on this demonstration. It was at 11 o'clock at night, and they threw us in jail, and then they took us to the city farm in Danville, Virginia, and I was laying there in this tight cell. They call it tight cell. It's very small, and it has no running water or anything like that. And they wouldn't feed me. They gave me a third of a biscuit and a cup of water, you know, every meal. And well, after 10 days, they gave me a physical examination to see if I could stand work in the rock hole. You know, it's these old rock holes where you knock big rocks into little rocks. And they took me out there, and I was bursting rocks with this 20-pound sledgehammer, and all of a sudden two white fellows came, and they stood around me, and they said, look, you're one of those demonstrators, aren't you? You know, and I said, yes. And they said, if you don't say right quick that you will stop these demonstrations, I'm going to hit you with this hammer. So I looked at him, and miraculously, I don't know, he dropped his hammer and he began to hit me with his fist, and he knocked me into some rocks. And the prison administration got me and took me into this cell. And when I got into this cell, he was put into the cell next to me. And I told him that I had forgiven him for what he had done. And he began to rant, you know, and say, well, I got to stop you, I got to stop you. I said, why? He said, if I don't stop you from marching in the streets, it won't mean anything for me to be white anymore. And this really struck me. This really struck me deep down within. And while I was there, when the policemen saw that I was in pretty good physical condition at fighting them, I guess they thought some God was with me or something. And at that time, I'd grown a beard. And they began to come in at night and say that I wish I could let you out, but I can't, you know. I wish I could feed you, you know, but they won't let me feed you. And then the prison administrator came in and said, Matthew, he said, you know, it's not the one difference between you and Jesus Christ. And I said, what is that? You know, he said, he's on heaven and you're on earth, you know. Well, it struck me because he's a very religious men, they said they ought to teach you, you know, Bible lessons in Sunday school every morning. But that really bothered me. I could see this jailer change from one position, from a position where he had just beaten Negro demonstrators with chains, you know, a week or so before, you know, and to a person that you could really talk to him. And we became fast friends, you know. And he gave me his address and told me to write him, you know. And he told us how, said, well, look, I know you're going to win, but I got to put these stumbling blocks in front of you, you know. I just have to do that. You know, it looks good, you know, this kind of thing. And I could see how he was just a slave to the system himself. In Atlanta, Georgia, last July 4th, there was an American Patriots rally. It was sort of a political rally, Wallace for president. And Wallace and Barnett were there. So 14 field secretaries, myself included, decided to go down to this rally to hear what George was talking about. And well, we walked into this place, not knowing really. We knew that there would be hostility, but we didn't know that that it was sort of a lynch mob type crowd. We just didn't know it. And we walked in, not knowing that this group of 10,000 people were gradually closing in behind us. You know, we got down into the stadium. I looked back up and I could see these 10,000 people, and a boo came, you know, a very loud boo, and then it got very quiet. And a woman threw a Coke down, and a man hit us with a newspaper. And all of a sudden, a man stood up with a chair, with an iron chair, and he made some kind of noise. And when he did that, 300 or 400 people stood up with chairs, and they began to hit us with these chairs. Well, the only thing I could think about was, this is it. You know, this is about the only thing that you can think of. And they hit us with chairs so that they knocked us into... knocked us unconscious. And I was laying down on the cement when suddenly I felt things light up a little bit. And when I wiped the blood out of my eyes to look up, and there was a policeman over me. And these chairs were just coming down on this policeman. You know, he didn't know which way to go. And I could hear people holler, kill a nigger, kill a nigger. And it really bothered me to hear this because it reminded me of the old Roman days, you know, when they used to put thumbs down on gladiators. And, well, a policeman grabbed me up, and he was still hitting him with the chairs. And he put me on the side of him, and he took me to a fence, and he put my hands on the fence. And I couldn't climb over the fence because I was too weak, and he lifted me over. But when I got over... people were coming out of the place, you know, telling the other SNCC field secretaries not to go in because they're killing them in there. And I believe in segregation, but I don't believe in this, you know. And there was a white girl in our company, and a white citizens council man came up, and he had put her head in his stomach, and he began to carry her out, and he told her that, look, I believe in segregation, but I have a daughter your age, you know. And he went out, and the girl told him, you know, that she had friends in there. And he also came back. We found out that he came back to see if we were out, too. And we found out that quite a few people changed from one position to another. And it really hurt Wallace in this state. He really couldn't operate in Georgia anymore because the people there knew what Wallace did to people. He really brought out this lynch mob kind of thing. He brought out all the evil in people.
A special report from the Council of Federated Organizations, Jackson, Mississippi. Despite Bunting's reading Peace on Earth, Goodwill Toward Men, the Christmas holidays in Mississippi were marred by bombings, beatings, and harassments. Mingled with Christmas carols was a cry for funds for the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, who are launching their drive to challenge the seating of the 5 Mississippi representatives in Congress come January the 4th. Voter registration drives continued, and the freedom schools operated by the Council of Federated Organizations functioned as usual. Throughout the state of Mississippi, Freedom Democratic Party members are holding fundraising activities to supply transportation to Washington, D.C. to challenge the seating in Congress of the 5 Mississippi representatives. The Freedom Democratic Party feel they have a constitutional right for the challenge.
Bombings and threats were the order of the day in Macomb and Holly Springs. In Summit, near southwest Macomb, Mississippi, the home of a Negro woman was bombed. She lives by herself about 25 feet from the highway. She is not affiliated with the civil rights movement in any way, although the sheriff said that the only damage was that the house was shaken a little bit. A reverend attached to the COFO project said that a 10 by 18 inch hole was blasted through the metal awning of her home. No one, fortunately, was injured. In Holly Springs on Christmas Day, the Antioch Baptist Church's mailbox was totally destroyed by a bomb. Later that same afternoon, a bomb was exploded about 4 miles down the road from the church, but no damage was reported. That afternoon in Holly Springs at the Antioch Church site, where workers are repairing some previous bomb damage, a worker was threatened by a white man who told him, quote, "You'll be sorry when that church is finished being repaired." Close of quotes. The man was recognized by some of the 20 people on hand at the time. Local authorities and the FBI were notified. Hill, the worker threatened, also is housing 6 students from Oberlin College who are in Holly Springs to help rebuild the church.
Desegregation attempts continued during the holiday season. In Laurel, Mississippi, 20 persons were arrested for trying to eat in at the Traveler's Inn coffee shop. And later that Christmas Eve night, 8 demonstrators carrying candles and wearing black armbands and singing freedom songs and Christmas carols were stopped from serenading the jailed persons by the high sheriff. He drove up and scattered the group by almost running them down in his car. After this incident, 4 observers, including Lou House, radio newsman from WAAF Radio in Chicago, were set upon by Jones County deputy sheriffs, and House's tape recorder was smashed, and then they were told to beat it or the Klan would get them. The tape recorder was recovered by a sergeant from the Laurel Police Department and returned to House the next day. The FBI called that night and was given the information about the incident. On Christmas Day, the 2 COFO communications workers and House left Laurel, but were again stopped in Covington County and detained an hour or so by Sheriff Bill Canfield. And in their detention, he wanted to discuss several things and issues about the rights movement here in Mississippi.
Sheriff Canfield marched in 2 Negro prisoners, a father and a son by the name of Sullivan, and asked them to explain how well Negroes were being treated in Covington County. Then he asked the 3 of us to talk with him alone so he would feel free to explain how good separate but equal facilities really are. Ironically, the younger Sullivan explained that he was in jail on a phony charge. Canfield kept calling his friends the Sullivans niggers. When we asked him whether he would encourage Negroes to vote, he said, "No, that isn't necessary. We take care of them all right down here. They don't need to vote." He said that Nikita Khrushchev, or whoever else was in charge now, was actually directing our government in Washington, D.C. He attacked President Johnson as a communist dupe and accused Martin Luther King and Vice President Humphrey as power-hungry politicians who wanted to take over the government. He said that his wish is that if civil rights workers went home, then there would be no problems. They're making the Negroes, he said, think and causing them trouble. They were happy before.
After this discussion, the group was issued a $12 fine for having improper functioning equipment on their car.
In Meridian, in the south central part of the state, Mrs. Fannie Lee Cheney, the mother of the slain civil rights worker James Cheney, was turned away from 2 restaurants and a movie theater. Mrs. Cheney and 2 friends attempted to enter the all-white eating places but were refused admittance or service. They told the manager that they had made reservations, but he refused anyway, saying that he would acknowledge the white person's reservation, but not Mrs. Cheney or the Negro member of the party. At another place, Mrs. Cheney was told, "We don't serve Negroes here." A group of white youth spat on a member of the group as they left the restaurant, but no other incidents happened at that point. The group went to the Lamar Hotel coffee shop, and there the manager refused them service. Mrs. Cheney said that she would continue her efforts to desegregate the public accommodations in Meridian.
In Hattiesburg, 7 teenagers successfully desegregated a previously all-white theater and were turned away from another on Christmas Day. The teenagers bought their tickets at the Sanger Theater in Hattiesburg and sat on the main floor without incident. In their next attempt at a rebel theater, they were turned away by the ticket taker and the manager, who said there was no more seats available. But as the group left the theater, they saw 4 whites purchase tickets and be admitted to the theater. In Macomb, it was learned that five men who admitted participation in racial violence had been released from their jobs with Illinois Central Railroad. The five were accused of bombing and other anti-racial activities in the Macomb area. The company spokesman said the five men were released for activities unbecoming ICRR employees. Earlier, 600 Macomb residents had signed a petition for the return to law and order in the Macomb area. Some 18,000 families received turkeys for Christmas in a project, Christmas for Mississippi, headed by Dick Gregory and Drew Pearson, and Vice Chairman Lawrence Landry of Chicago, and Honorary Co-Chairman Mahalia Jackson of Chicago. Four cab drivers from Chicago, DUOC Local 777, also accompanied the cargo to Jackson, Mississippi to help distribute the birds. Distribution was handled from 10 points in Mississippi, and according to reports, there were many families enjoying turkey for the first time in their lives, like Mrs. Haywood, 80 years old, of Jackson, who said, "God bless all those fine people responsible for this day."
In Starkville, a white Protestant church was integrated for the first time. Three local Negroes, two out-of-state white ministers, and one COPO worker asked an usher if they could join in the worship services, and to the happy surprise of everyone, they were shown to their seats. Although police were waiting outside, there were no incidents. The preacher greeted all the new guests and said, when he saw one of them, "At least at this moment, I am very happy and very proud to be a Christian minister." He noticed a "We Shall Overcome" button, a student nonviolent coordinating committee symbol, on one member, and he looked him in the eye and wished him good luck.
This has been a report from the Council of Federated Organizations, Jackson, Mississippi.
One bright sunny morning.
And that does it for this week's From the Vault. If you would like to join our campus campaign, sponsoring school libraries across the country with these recordings, visit us online at pacificaradioarchives.org or call us toll-free at 1-800-735-0230. This program is written and produced by Mark Torres and Brian DeShazer. The series is executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and your host, Brian DeShazer. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and past grants from the American Archive, funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and partnerships with UC Berkeley Moffitt Library and the Pacifica Foundation and its members. And new this week, we'd like to thank the Internet Archive and Brewster Kahle for donating services to complete the digitization of our station folio program guides. We're also adding our thanks to Other Minds Archives and Charles Armacadian and his staff, as well as City Lights Books. More on those collaborations in upcoming programs. Our theme music is by Kevin Drum Holiday. Thanks for listening and keeping our history alive.